this is the last lecture, and yet I've really only covered half the material I would have wanted to cover in a course on quantum foundations. It would have been good to cover some of the stuff that happened actually this century, this millennium. But in fact, the stuff I was talking about at the last lecture was what happened in the 1980s. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happened, of course, this century. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about a paper that I wrote back in 2001. So that's just about this century. And there's a lot of work being done in this kind of field in recent years. So this is an operational reconstruction of quantum theory. There's many other operational reconstructions of quantum theory happened in the meantime. So I'm going to talk about the work I did in 2001. So this paper, you'll find it on the archive. It's quant PH. They changed the numbering system on the archive. So I forget when they did that exactly, but prior to that, the numbers would have a kind of a subject before and then the number. Okay, so here's the idea. We have a theory of quantum theory. We want to reconstruct it from some set of sort of axioms or postulates, whatever. And we're going to do it in an operational setting. I'll explain what I mean by that. So the motivation for this kind of endeavor is, you know, you look at the usual axioms of quantum theory, and they're pretty abstract. And they're essentially ad hoc. I mean, where do those axioms come from? Why Hilbert space? Why complex Hilbert space? Why operators and so on? And you can contrast that with the situation in, consider, for example, special relativity. So there you have the two axioms of special relativity, that the physics is the same in every frame of reference, and that the speed of light is the same, a constant measured in any frame of reference. And if you look actually before special relativity, before special relativity, you had Maxwell's equations, and Maxwell's equations had the symmetry of special relativity, but it wasn't clear why it had that symmetry. So when you look here, you have kind of simple axioms that tell you why you have the Lorentz transformations. Another example from history is if you look at Kepler's laws of planetary motion, it's not really clear where they came from. They're interesting laws, you know, that planets sweep out equal areas in equal times and so on. Move on elliptical orbits, but it's not clear why nature would have ordered those particular laws. However, when you get to Newton's dynamics, his three laws plus his law of universal gravitation, then you can explain where Kepler's laws come from. And so what we have currently is quantum theory with a bunch of abstract axioms. And the question is, can you put something here that would help to explain where those axioms come from? There's a reason to want to do that kind of thing is that then you can think about going beyond In the case of well, in the case of Newton's laws, it turns out that they applied not just to planetary motion, but to you know, to comets, for example, coming from, or to bodies coming from outside, way outside the solar system, on hyperbolic orbits, or in fact, basically to any motion. So you could do, even for the planets, you could do, you could calculate corrections to the planet's motions because they perturb each other. So so Newton's theory helps us go beyond. In the case of special relativity, you can go, you can in fact go beyond special relativity. When you, once you start thinking like this, then you can make the transition to general relativity. So it's hard to imagine making the transition directly from Maxwell's equations to GR without having this understanding of special relativity in the middle. So there's a question: can something like this help us go to quantum gravity? If you understand more deeply where the structure of quantum theory comes from. So what I have to offer you here today in this position isn't, of course, as striking as what we have here and here. It's more just an idea for how to do this. And there's been other sets, other reconstructions of quantum theory in the meantime. None of them, I think, have found the perfect set of axioms from which you can derive quantum theory, but I think there's some kind of progress there. Okay. What do I mean by operational? Well, let's imagine, let's just imagine we have boxes. Here's a box that prepares. This is a preparation. And it prepares some system. And then this thing might move through a transformation. And then finally go on to be measured. And the measurement might have various different outcomes. Okay. So this is an operational scenario. You're just describing it in terms of boxes that are placed, one after the other. And you can certainly consider more general operational scenarios than this. But let's just take this scenario for the time being. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'll write down the five axioms, a version of the axioms I originally wrote in this paper. But before I do that, I want to introduce a few ideas. So first of all, I want to just introduce the idea of a state. So here's the idea. Well, what is it we want a state to do in this kind of context? Well, here we're interested in probabilistic theories. We want to calculate the probabilities of different outcomes. And let's just make it a bit simple. Let's imagine we have a preparation followed by measurement. And then we have lots of different possible measurements, and each measurement has different outcomes. We'll label the outcomes of so alpha is going to label is labels outcome and measurement pairs. So we have a given measurement and a given outcome that's labeled by alpha. Another outcome of the same measurement might be a different alpha, would be a different alpha, and then also another measurement with an outcome would be yet again a different alpha. So these alphas run over all possible outcomes of all possible measurements. Okay. What we want our state to do is to be able to give us the probability for any outcome of any measurement on that preparation. Is that clear? Have I explained that? That's really all the empirical all the empirical stuff you can derive from this kind of situation. Okay. Now, typically, in physical theories, these different P alphas are related to one another. And you can, rather than writing them down all separately, you can write down just a subset of them, which I'll write like this. Like so. One thing I should mention is what I'm doing here is for finite dimensional Hilbert space quantum theory. Okay. So here's the idea. We take this big long list, we write down a subset of these alphas, and then I label that subset by 1 through k. And I want it to be such that the probability any p alpha is given by a linear combination of these p's here. Okay. So for any alpha in this big set, you can find there's a vector R sub alpha such that this probability P alpha is given by this dot product. This is a kind of linear compression. And we want to do it such that K is the minimum possible k that will work. Okay, so if we could find another set of probabilities with even fewer, a set of a list of probabilities which had even fewer, then that's the k we would choose. So we choose the we want to make k the shortest list we can. Okay, any questions at this stage? So let me give you an example. So imagine we have a spin half particle. So it could be like a qubit, basically, in. And we want to write down the density matrix for the spin half particle. Has everyone covered density matrices? Anyone not? Yeah, that's familiar to people. Okay. So this will be the density matrix. Along the diagonal, it would have the probabilities, or depends on the basis you write it in, but in this basis, the probability we have on the numbers on the diagonal are the probabilities of getting spin up along the z direction. And the probability of getting spin down along the z direction. And then on the off diagonal, we have these complex numbers. And you can write down A, this complex number, as, and as, there's a caveat I'll give you in just a moment, which is that this may be wrong because I can't quite remember what the answer is. There's a minus here. Okay, but I'm not 100% sure what the coefficients are, so there's an exercise just to verify that this is correct or find the right answer. Anyway, this is the probability of getting spin up along the x direction. This is the probability of getting spin up along the y direction. So what's interesting here is that these off-diagonal terms are just given by a linear combination of various probabilities. Okay. And so what that means is that you can write this same information you have in the density matrix, you can just write it like this. Those four probabilities enable you to calculate all the entries in the density matrix and vice versa. And furthermore, these objects are linear with respect to one another. Okay. Yep, go ahead.
Why do we need p? Is it minus? Can we just write this one?
Right, good question. If you impose normalization, then this thing here is equal to 1, and indeed, you only need one of these. However, it's convenient not to normalize because like typically after a transformation that might absorb the system or might after a transformation you can typically get subnormalized states. I'm not going to have time to talk about that in detail, but it's convenient to do that. It also makes everything linear, whereas if you impose that normalization, then it becomes affine. And furthermore, you get the non-linearity associated with renormalizing your state. So keeping all those four numbers in is a way to make everything nice and linear. Okay. And now we know that in standard quantum theory, the probability of getting a particular outcome is given by taking the trace of some positive operator associated with the particular outcome of the particular measurement you're interested in times the density matrix associated with that. Okay. And in this framework here, we have this formula. So you can see, well, we know there's a linear map between rho and p, and there's also clearly a linear map between the operator here and the r sub alpha. Okay. So quantum theory maps into this more general way of thinking about probability theories. That's clearly a good thing. But actually, you can also let me just finish this. You can also, I'll show you afterwards, you can also put classical probability theories in this framework as well, and indeed more general theories if you can think of them. Just before I move on from quantum theory, it's interesting to draw the space of states in quantum theory. So now I'm going to impose, I'm just going to look at the normalized states. So if you just look at the normalized states and now draw some axes for x plus, PY plus and PZ plus. And okay, this is my attempt to draw a cube. Okay, I've drawn a unit cube here. Can anyone say something about the space of allowed states here? Anyone know? No? Okay.
Simplex?
No, that'll be in the classical case, it'll be a simplex. Okay. So for a qubit, a spin half particle, the space of allowed states, normally states, is this, are the states that fit inside a or inside or on a sphere that fits inside this cube I've drawn. Okay. So you take a sphere that sort of touches the six walls of this cube, and then states that are on that surface are the pure states. States that are inside are mixed states, and points outside that ball are not allowed. You can't prepare those. And this is this sphere is this well ball is the block ball that you may have come across. It's in different coordinates from the ones you normally have. I think these are more natural coordinates because you can see the probabilities, the range between 0 and 1. If you're at the top, then you have a spin up along the z direction. If you're at the bottom, you have spin down. And then similar remarks, spin up along x at the front here, spin down at the back, and so on. Spin y plus here. Okay, so that's the block ball. In different coordinates. And one thing to notice is that the pure states, there's a continuous set of pure states. Okay, if you, there's a pure state here, there's another one here. And there's a continuous trajectory from any one pure state to any other. I'm using the word pure states. I should really give you a definition of what I mean by pure state. So a pure state is a state which is not mixed. A mixed state is a state like this, which can be written as a convex combination of some other states . So if you have two states which are distinct, you have a convex combination where the convex parameter here is greater than 0 and less than 1, then that's a mixed state. You can think of this as just corresponding to preparing state A or state B and tossing a coin to decide which state you prepare. Okay. So this mathematical process of taking the convex combination can correspond to the physical process of mixing two states. Based upon a coin toss. And then so pure states, ones which are not pure. Sorry, ones which are not mixed. So pure states are ones which are not mixed. If you look at the surface here, you can see those are the pure states are the ones on the surface. Whereas the states on the interior of the ball are mixed states. Incidentally, and I won't really have time to cover this, but the qubit, the spin, the n equals 2 system with two-dimensional Hilbert space is special in that all the states on the surface are also pure states. If you consider higher dimensional systems like n equal to 3 and so on, then you'll have states, you'll have parts of the surface which are flat. In fact, generically, the surface points on the surface will be flat. But nevertheless, you can still go from any pure state via continuous trajectory to any other pure state. Okay. So here's another sort of theory, so classical probability theory. So imagine you have a classical trit. So a classical bit is a system which can be in like one or two states, like a coin. A trit would have one or three states. Let's label them 0, 1, and 2. And then we can think about the probability theory by drawing a graph like this, and then the maximum value any one of these can take is 1. And when any of these properties is equal to 1, then the other two must be 0. And then the set of allowed states are here. If you allow subnormalization, then you get all of you get both the surface here I've drawn, this triangle, and then also all the states that go down to the origin. So you get this, what is this shape? I forget the name of the shape, but it's a kind of pyramid. So that would be the space of shapes that you'd get. Now here, of course, because I had enough dimensions, I've drawn the whole space, whereas here I imposed this normalization. So I've just drawn the ball. In this case, if you didn't impose normalization, then this would be the sort of the top of the cone. This will be the top of the cone, and then you'd have smaller and smaller spheres disappearing at the origin. Okay, if you try to draw this in four dimensions. Okay. In the case of the qubit, you have n equal to 2. What I mean is you have two states which can be perfectly distinguished in a single shot measurement. And that would be like, for example, spin up or spin down along any given direction. In this example, you have n equal to 3. In general, there's an operational notion of n, which is the maximum number of states which can be perfectly distinguished, so distinguished in a single shot measurement. And the idea is you have your preparations, you have your measurements, and your measurements have outcomes, and you can consider a set of states P1, P2, all the way up to Pn, where each of these states, there exists a measurement here such that each of these states gives rise to a disjoint set of outcomes. Okay, so maybe P1 gives rise to this outcome, P2 to this outcome, P3 to these two outcomes, okay, and so on. The sets can have more than one outcome in them. If you have something like this, then you can, if you send a preparation in, you can tell which preparation, if it's one of these, you can tell which one it was in a single shot measurement. Okay, is that clear? So this is an important concept. An n kind of conveys, and we take n to be the maximum number of elements in such a set. So if you can find, you look at all sets of states which can be distinguished, and you find the one which has the maximum number of such elements, maybe more than one, it may not be unique, and then that's the value of n. So n tells you something about the information carrying capacity of this system here. Okay. Typically, the information carrying capacity is given by log of n. Log to the base 2 of n is... So the log to the base 2 of n is the information carrying capacity. Any questions? All clear? Good. Okay. So what I'll do now is I'll write down a set of axioms which are sufficient to give you finite dimensional quantum theory. So it gives you, what I mean by finite dimensional quantum theory is it gives you the space of states, the space of transformations that are possible, and the space of measurements. So let's write these down. I'll give each axiom a name. So the first one I call the information axiom. So the first one says that systems having or constrained to have a given information carrying capacity have the same properties. There's a few ideas in there which I haven't made clear. So you can constrain a system to have a certain information carrying capacity if you consider just preparations that give rise only to a subset of the possible outcomes associated with some set of distinguishable states. For example, if you only consider outcomes that give rise, so if you only consider preparations that give rise to outcomes in here or here, then you've constrained to a two dimension, to an n equals two, you've constrained to a system which has the information carrying capacity of n equals two, so a log of n equals two is one. And so that's a way of constraining, just by only considering preparations that give rise to a subset of these outcomes associated with a subset of some set of perfectly distinguishable states. Okay. And you think about it classically, you know, if you have like a classical trait, like I talked about here, but now you constrain your preparations so that you only allow outcomes consistent with zero or one, then you've effectively got a classical bit. Okay, and that system, being constrained in that way, will have all those properties. Okay, axiom two. So axiom two says that if you have a composite system, AB, then n for that composite system is equal to nA times nB. And you can think of that as being like the addition of information carrying capacities. So if you take the log of this equation, you get log of nAB equals log of A plus log of B. Okay. You know, if you have a memory stick, do people still use memory sticks? Anyway, if you have a memory stick that has information carrying capacity of 2 gigabytes, and you have another one that has an information carrying capacity of 3 gigabytes, then the total information carrying capacity of those two memory sticks is 5 gigabytes. Okay. And this is saying that same kind of thing. So this is certainly true for classical probability theory. It's also true in quantum theory because when you have a Hilbert space associated with a composite system, you take the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces corresponding to each of the subsystems. So this is true there as well. Okay. So the third axiom is tomographic locality. It also concerns composite systems. So K, remember, is the number of probabilities you require to specify the state over there. And it says that KAB for a composite system is equal to KA times KB. There's a lot more to say about tomographic locality, but I think it's a very natural that when you put two systems together, you end up just with the product number of degrees of freedom. And it is so this is true in quantum theory, and it's interesting because we spend a lot of time talking about entanglement and saying that a composite system has something in, there's something about a composite system which cannot be described locally in terms of its parts, and that's true. However, there is also something which is much more prosaic about a composite system, that you can just take, to get the number of degrees of freedom, the number of probabilities, you can just take this product. So it's kind of what you would expect. Okay, just two more. Two more axioms. So the next one is a continuity axiom. And remember, I mentioned in the quantum case, there is this continuous space of pure states. Okay, that's not true in the classical case. If you're here, so your system is definitely in the state zero, and you want to go to the state one, you kind of have to jump. There's no continuous evolution that takes you from the state zero to the state one. Whereas in the quantum case, if you're in a state over here corresponding to, say, spin up along the z direction, let's call that state one, then there is a continuous evolution that takes you to any other pure state. So this tells you, this says there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. By reversible, you mean that you can find a transformation that does the opposite for any state. So a transformation takes takes states from one state to another. The reverse transformation just reverses that for any state. So this gives you a kind of group structure, and then you can use various theorems from group theory to help you make progress. Okay, and then the last axiom. Is simplicity. And this, I think, is the weakest of the axioms in this set of axioms. And a lot of the work that was done subsequently by various people, including myself, were attempts to remove this simplicity axiom. But let me tell you what it says, and then I'll explain to you what work this simplicity axiom does. So systems are described by the smallest number of probabilities.
This is K.
Consistent with the other axioms. Okay. So, to explain what this last axiom is doing, let me just show you a few things. So, first of all, the very first axiom, the information axiom, tells us that K is a function of N, because K is a property of a system, and so K should just depend on N, because different systems having the same N have the same properties. You can also show, and I won't go into details, this is a reasonable property, that K of N plus 1 is necessarily greater than K of N. You can show that just by thinking about mixtures of preparations and so on. The second and third axioms tell us that K of N A N B is equal to K of N A times K of N B. This is a property in mathematics, in number theory, known as being completely multiplicative. So this is a completely multiplicative function. Now you can show from these different properties I've mentioned that K is equal to n to the power r, where r is equal to 1, 2, etc., some integer, which characterizes the particular theory that you're in. And now it's interesting to go back and look at, first of all, let's look at classical probability theory. Well, here you can see n equals to 3, but also the size of this space, the number of probabilities, is also 3. And in general, in classical theory, you have k equal to n, which is the special case where r equals 1. What about quantum theory? Over here, well, this is a special case where n was equal to 2. And then you can see that there are 4 probabilities in that list. So there, k is equal to 4. And you can show in general that in quantum theory, k equals n squared. OK. What about these higher theories? What about k equals n cubed or k equals n to the power 4 and so on? Well, people have tried to write down theories like that, but none of them are really very nice. You can try to construct them. An interesting question is, well, if you look at the transition, you look at k equals n squared, well, we know that classical probability theory is kind of hidden inside quantum theory, because if you insist that all your density matrices are diagonal in a certain basis, then you end up getting classical probability theory. So if you impose decoherence on quantum theory, you just have classical probability theory. And there's an interesting question. What about if you constructed one of these higher theories, r equals, where you know, had k equals n cubed, for example? Is there some kind of decoherence that takes you from that down to quantum theory? Well, not obviously so far. There's nothing really very compelling that's been done in that direction, but it's an interesting question. So what the last axiom is doing, the simplicity axiom, it's saying, let's take basically the smallest value of R. That's consistent with the other axioms. And so that gives us k equals n squared, because k equals n, when r equals 1, is inconsistent with the continuity axiom. Okay. Now, to actually prove that quantum theory follows from this set of axioms is non-trivial, you have to go through a lot of work. And you can read about that in the paper I mentioned. Or you can read about the more recent approaches in other papers. So you sort of set up this this framework. This framework nowadays, where you have these lists of probabilities and so on, it generally goes by the name of GPT, General Probability Theories. In that context, you can write down sets of postulates and try to restrict yourself to quantum theory. We have a visitor at the moment, Alex Wills, who is going to give a course. He will give a course on GPTs. So if you're interested in that, incidentally, let me know about it and I will convey that. So are there questions on what I've said at this stage? Yeah, go ahead.
You've talked about probabilities throughout this lecture. You've never mentioned amplitudes.
Yeah, that's right.
So I just want to clarify that you really are talking about probabilities throughout.
Yeah, so it's interesting that once you go to this mixed state approach, where did I write down the there? Okay. So you can get the mixed state by writing, you know, pure states back to back. So mixed state is given by something like this. These pure states have amplitudes in them because they're sums of things. And then when you put them back to back like this, those amplitudes multiply, and then you sum over them, and then you get an object like the object I have here. So the amplitudes get socked into that. But then you end up going over to this way of thinking, which is linear in probability, rather than kind of square root. Amplitudes are kind of go as the square root of probabilities. And you can do all of quantum theory in this way, and these axioms apply to that way of thinking. So in some sense, amplitudes are conceptually secondary from this point of view, I would say, rather than being primary.
So the K in number 5 is probabilities, as you say.
It's the number of probabilities you require.
Because you've got a much larger dimensionality for amplitudes.
Right. So there's something interesting. I mentioned here that in the case of n equals to 2, all of the states on the surface are also pure states. And pure states are ones that can be parameterized by a pure state like this, in fact like this. One of the advantages of doing this is that you end up losing the overall phase factor, which is not physically relevant. So pure states are like this. If you go to higher dimensions, then the set of allowed states, the states on the surface become different. And so maybe I can just mention that. If I have something like this, which is equal to let's write it as a n. Then the number of real parameters in this, let's call the number of real parameters L, is equal to each of these is complex, so 2n. But then we lose one parameter because of an overall phase indifference. And if you want this to be normalized, you lose one more parameter. So that's just minus 2. So that's the number of real parameters required to specify the pure states. Whereas k is equal to n squared in quantum theory. So if you just take the surface, the number of parameters required to represent the surface, let's call that m. So this is the surface of the convex object. Then that's n squared minus 1, because the surface is just one dimension less. So in a special case where n is equal to 2, then so if n is equal to 2, then you have, what's that, 2 times 2, 4 minus 2 is 2. And here you have, sorry, you also want to impose normalization here. So that's minus number 1, so that's minus 2. So if you look at the normalized states and you look at the surface of the normalized states, then you see for the special case where n equals 2, this and this agree. But in general, they don't agree. So n equal to 3, the surface has higher dimension than the set of pure states. So one way to picture that is the Pringle. If you take a circle, and then imagine take a piece of wire in the shape of a circle, and then you bend it gently. Okay, this is hard to draw. I need to actually bring a piece of wiring with me. Trying to draw a piece of wire that's been bent. There was a circle that's been bent. Okay, something like this. Okay, so this is a circle. Now I've just bent it, so it's no longer in a plane. And then I can form what's called the convex hull of this. So I just I take all convex combinations of points on this piece of wire, and I end up getting a three-dimensional object. So the surface of this three-dimensional object is two-dimensional, but the set of pure states, if you like, is just one-dimensional. So this is kind of like a Pringle, the shape of Pringle. This is really a toy example. It's not really a proper example, but it just gives you an idea of how it's possible to have the extremal set of points be of lower dimension than the surface. Okay. So quantum theory is like that, not exactly like this, but it has that property. Any other questions? Axioms. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So in that middle board, you express the probability as being trace of an operator with the density matrix.
That's right. Yeah.
So the operator is, I assume, positive.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It won't be a probability because
yeah,
it's an expectation value when you take a trace with an operator.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, this definition of mixed state. Can we see how this relates to the conventional definition of mixed state, which is trace of rho squared is less than 1.
Okay. yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things to say about that. I'm just wondering how to say it in the short amount of time I have. Like in previous versions of this course, I've talked a bit about that condition and how you can turn it into an interesting set of conditions. But maybe one thing to think about that condition, trace of rho squared, is it's a quadratic condition. So it's imposing a quadratic constraint on the probabilities, which is consistent with something which, like in the case of a qubit, it ends up giving you the conditions for a sphere. And so it kind of, it restricts you to points on the sphere, and so that's kind of what's going on. There's an interesting set of conditions that that you can talk about, which sort of go beyond that. I'd have to spend 20 minutes talking about that. So I think basically the quadratic nature of that condition is tells you that you're on some quadratic surface, and that's the set of pure states. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
We talked about density matrices of mixed states for the quantum state, but when we were talking classically, we were kind of saying there's sort of one or a zero. Mm-hmm. We didn't discuss mixed states for classicals?
So I kind of touched on it briefly. If you want to a state here, for example, if I took a mixture of the zero state and the two state, then it would be somewhere along this line. Okay. And so this point would be a mixed state, and indeed any point except these three points would be mixed states.
But we said it wasn't continuous.
Yeah, so what you can't do is if you can go from here to here by mixing. Okay, so you can start here, and then you can slowly introduce some component which is P2, and you can go to here. What you can't do is you can't go from here to here in a way which uses only reversible transformations. So transformations which are reversible on any state, it's not possible to go from here to here and then back again using those
states.
Yeah. Using continuously reversible transformations. You can use, there's discrete transformations, so a set of permutations. So you just permute 0 to 1. But that's a jump. It doesn't take you in a continuous way, so that's what's not possible. Okay. So usually I end this course by talking about my regrets, as in the things I didn't get to cover. And there's a bunch of interesting subjects out there. So let me just talk about those. So if you're interested in foundations, here's a few things I didn't cover which I think are important. So contextuality. Quantum theory has this interesting property that it's contextual. It means really that that if you try to say that measurements have pre-existing values, then those pre-existing values have to depend on the particular measurement that you're performing. Okay, so they depend on the context. So this is due to Koch and Specker, and also Rob Speckens here has an interesting new take on contextuality. And then there's the question about whether the wave function is ontic, so reality. So is the wave function real? And there's a proof with some assumptions that wave functions do have to be real, have to be ontic. So if you search on PBR, that's Pusey, Barrett, and Rudolph. Then you'll find that. Actually, so Matt Pusey was a postdoc here for a while, and I think it was the 2015 version of this course, the penultimate lecture, he gave a talk on the reality of the wave function. So this is a very interesting theorem that proves that you do have psi-ontic under certain assumptions. Indefinite causality. So this is motivated by considerations from quantum gravity. If you have a superposition of different metrics, then you have something like a superposition of different causal structures. So that means there's no matter of the fact as to whether you have one causal structure or another. So this is something you can think about. You can try to write down a sort of a general probabilistic theory for this situation. So I did that in a paper in 2005. It has the keyword is causaloid. You can consider cases where a system where you have two events A or B, and you might want to have a superposition of whether A happens before B or B before A. So there's some interesting work on that. Goes by the name of causal inequalities. So this is Oreshkov, Costa, and Bruckner. And then one more subject I think has been in vogue recently, I think it's very interesting, are extended Bigner-Friend arguments. So Bigner's friend is where you imagine that there's a box with a guy inside who does some quantum measurement, and that's Bigner's friend. Bigner himself is outside the box. He can't see the outcome of the measurement. And then you can discuss that from a quantum point of view. In the case of extended Bigner's friends, you have typically two friends and two Bigners, and you can get some very interesting arguments there that sort of question the consistency of quantum theory in certain ways. So there's work on that by Bruckner, and then also by Renner and Fauchinger. So you'll find that stuff. And yeah, I'll stop there. Thank you.